From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Margot Adler, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Ugandan AIDS activist Noreen Kaliba. She's been at the forefront of the AIDS fight for 15 years, ever since her husband died from the disease. She formed an AIDS support group after watching the stigma he faced. Now she works for UNAIDS and is the author of the book We Miss You All. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Norman Granz's jazz at the Philharmonic, Carnegie Hall, 1949. And film critic John Powers reviews the new French film, Time Out. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Palestinian officials said today a U.S. envoy was not able to make any progress during 2 hours of talks with Yasser Arafat. A top Palestinian official says Arafat told the envoy the Israeli pullback from parts of the West Bank was merely cosmetic. Meanwhile, an Israeli soldier and five Palestinians died today as violence continued in the West Bank. Israelis say the victims included a leader of the Hamas military wing in the Nablus area. As President Bush prepares to discuss the Middle East crisis this week with Arab monarchs from Morocco and Saudi Arabia, the leader of the Senate's Democratic majority today staked out a strong pro-Israeli stance in a speech to a powerful Jewish lobby group. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle told the annual convention of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, that as long as he leads the Senate, Israel will have a friend both in fair weather and foul.
We must all recognize Israel's right to defend itself. And we must not only be recognized, it must be supported in every case and in every situation.
AIPAC gave Democratic candidates $4.3 million in the last election, twice what it gave Republicans. While Daschle refrained from any criticism of Israel's deadly incursions into Palestinian territories, he did endorse a Senate resolution offered by fellow Democrat Joe Lieberman. It says the U.S. stands in solidarity with what's described as Israel's dismantling of the terrorist infrastructure in Palestinian areas. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Pentagon has accused Iraq of moving more surface-to-air missile batteries into the so-called no-fly zones. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Richard Myers told a news conference the missile batteries threaten U.S. and British pilots who patrol the no-fly zones. Sri Lanka's president has arrived in India on a visit that's expected to focus on new efforts to end the island nation's civil war. India does not want an active role in the peace process, but its support is crucial. Veer Singh has more from New Delhi.
President Chandrika Kumaratunga of Sri Lanka is due to brief India's top leaders on efforts to hold landmark peace talks between the Sri Lankan government and Tamil Tiger rebels. Kumaratunga and the Indian government deeply distrust the Tamil Tigers, although for somewhat different reasons, and both know that they have the power to derail the latest peace process in Sri Lanka. But with the eyes of the world on them, they do not want to be seen as obstacles to peace. In Sri Lanka, negotiations with the Tamil rebels are being led by President Kumaratunga's arch-political rival, Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe. He has promised to meet with Indian leaders before holding face-to-face talks with the Tigers, which are expected to take place in June. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 120 points. The Nasdaq fell 38. You're listening to NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court has decided to hear a case that involves the use of the government's anti-racketeering law against abortion protesters. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
Justices will decide whether or not the racketeering law should be applied to people who have protested outside clinics where abortions are performed. The RICO law, as it is called, was first used to prosecute organized crime groups for illegal activity such as gambling. The court will hear a 16-year-old case. Members of Operation Rescue and others were convicted of conspiring to use blockades and violence to shut down clinics. The National Organization for Women, along with two clinics, filed the lawsuit. In 1990, the nation's highest court ruled that the law could be used to stop protesters. A jury found the defendants guilty and awarded $250,000 in damages. But anti-abortion protesters continue to appeal, arguing that the racketeering law has not been applied correctly and is being used to stop free speech. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
In Washington today, protesters marched to the Capitol calling for an end to military aid to Colombia. They object to a proposal by the Bush administration to let U.S. aid now tied to the drug war be used by the Colombian military to fight guerrillas. The State Department and the United Nations both have criticized the human rights record of the Colombian military. President Bush defended his environmental record this Earth Day, walking through the Adirondacks. The president says his Clear Skies plan can reduce smog and mercury emissions and stop acid rain. But former rival Al Gore says polluters are in charge of the president's environmental policies. Gore said his opponent promised to reduce greenhouse gases, then made that the first promise he broke just one day after taking office. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Oceana, proud co-sponsor of the film Empty Oceans, Empty Nets, airing today, Earth Day, on PBS. Local listings at oceansatrisk.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, Noreen Kaliba, has been working on the front lines of the HIV/AIDS epidemic for 15 years. Her activism began when her late husband, Chris, was diagnosed with AIDS in the mid-80s. Kaliba herself never caught the disease. After dealing with her husband's illness and death, she founded TASO, one of the earliest AIDS support organizations in Africa. HIV/AIDS is the leading cause of death in sub-Saharan Africa. Almost 30 million of the 40 million people infected live in that part of the world. And of the 15,000 new infections every day, 95% occur in Africa south of the Sahara. Uganda was hit hard early in the epidemic, but its president took active measures. Among them, he set up a committee on AIDS, and Kaliba became part of that committee. She is now the Community Mobilization Advisor for UNAIDS in Geneva. Several years ago, she wrote the book We Miss You All, to help other women who were watching their loved ones die of AIDS. When did you first hear the word AIDS in your life?
That is some time. Must have been in the early 80s, and I think was in 1982. And that's when I read a magazine that was describing an illness that had been described in among white homosexual men in San Francisco. And and at that stage, like I suspect many people in the rest of the world, I dismissed it as something that had very little to do with me.
And then you had your first real encounter, and that was when your husband, Chris, became sick with AIDS.
Yes, that was 1986 when Christopher, my late husband, was diagnosed with AIDS. But earlier than that, I had actually met my first person with HIV. Again, that meeting was very brief and was promptly dismissed from my life because I am a physiotherapist by profession, and I used to work in one of the teaching hospitals, the largest teaching hospital in Uganda. So this young man that I met in 1985 was ill with AIDS, and he had a complication that had left him paralyzed from the waist downwards. So I had been looking towards like we do in teaching hospitals, using him for my students to learn how to learn the skills of transferring a person who is paralyzed from bed to wheelchair. I went to this young man and asked his permission, asked if my students would go that afternoon to use him. And he was very gracious and agreed. But after inquiring from the ward sister, and when the ward sister told me that this young man had AIDS and also warned me not to touch him, I never went back to that young man. And that was 1985, a year before my own husband, Christopher, would be diagnosed with AIDS.
Now, at first, you didn't know it was AIDS because he was having some symptoms for some time before, correct?
Yes, because Christopher had left home, had left Uganda, and had been for a year in England as a student, a postgraduate student. And he had intended to stay and finish his studies in a year. And I had stayed home with my four children. But from time to time during that year, whenever we talked with him, he would be complaining of some ailments. But, you know, from that distance, it was very difficult to even name what the illness was. And certainly there was no way I could have connected the illnesses that he was describing with AIDS, because at the time I was very, at least one thing, I was really sure that AIDS did not affect people like me, certainly not people who are married and heterosexual and not white and not living in San Francisco. So basically, in my own mind, I didn't think, even when the message came to me that Christopher had AIDS, my first reaction was denial, very violent denial, because I felt they had made a mistake.
When your husband was diagnosed, at that point, did you have a sense that there was a lot of stigma attached to AIDS? I think that you write that in the beginning, your first experience was one in which there was less stigma than you later experienced.
Exactly, because after Christopher was diagnosed, and like I have said before, he was living in England as a student, so he was admitted into a hospital, Castle Hill Hospital in England. And after getting the news, I went to England to be with him in hospital, sort of accompany him through that very, very difficult time. And during that time, I learned a lot about AIDS. One of the things I was told about AIDS was that AIDS had a very huge stigma attached to it. But during our stay in hospital at Castle Hill, we were never exposed to that kind of stigma. We were loved. We were cared for. We were really treated as special in a way, to the extent that the discussion about stigma related to HIV didn't hit me until we were discharged from England. We went back to our own country, and that is when the whole Pandora's box was opened.
You say that when Chris first came home to Uganda, when he arrived, there were people who were just there just because they wanted to see a person with AIDS.
It was amazing, a very amazing spectacle, because perhaps to go back a little bit, because I didn't quite believe that Christopher would have AIDS, when I received the news, I told everybody, and this was before I went to England. I told everybody, I told my family, I told my friends at work. So the fact that, you know, and the way I would tell people would be like, well, I think they are making a big mistake. They say he has AIDS. How can he have AIDS? So I, through that kind of denial and kind of trying to assert myself that cannot be true, I had told everybody. So by the time I got to England and I realized that it wasn't a myth that Christopher had AIDS, that Christopher was dying with AIDS, I suppose it was too late for me to retrieve the information that I had shared, such that by the time Christopher came home, quite a number of people knew that he had AIDS. But many people had never seen a person with AIDS. So the people who turned up at the airport to receive him back, many turned up out of curiosity to see a person with HIV. And many really were very afraid.
He spent how long in Uganda after he came home?
He came back on the 30th of October, and he died on the 23rd of January the following year. So he came back on the 30th of October, 1986, and died on January 23, 1987.
And
so it was really a very short time just before he died.
And the stigma that you experienced in Uganda, how did that manifest?
The first manifestation, sadly, came from the healthcare workers. I remember the whole time, because that first admission, we were in hospital for 10 days. And the whole of those 10 days, no healthcare worker touched my husband. And no healthcare worker came into the room where he and I were staying. They would come to the door and stand at the door and inquire about his health. I look back now and I say perhaps it was also because I am a healthcare worker, and I was determined to do what care, to give what care my husband needed. So I was and I was also feeling very angry, and I tried to show people that I could do it. So most of the nursing care that he needed, and he needed 24 hours nursing care, including changing drips, including changing all his bed linen and washing him, was done by me, my mother-in-law, and one wonderful good friend. So that was the first manifestation. But also during that time, we have four children. And at that time, our children were very, very young. Elizabeth, who is today 26 years, was 13. And she was the oldest of the four. And she was going to primary school at that time. And Marion and Fiona and Christine, they were all going to primary school. But word quickly went round that Christopher had AIDS. So their peers, their friends at school, stopped playing with them. Oh, I remember Elizabeth coming home and saying, "Mommy, I'm not going back to school. My friend will not share my biscuit," because she says, "Daddy has AIDS, and Mommy, do I have AIDS? And what is AIDS?"
And what did you tell her?
Fortunately, we had made a decision quite early with Christopher that we would tell the children. So we had actually sat down with when this came up, we sat Marion, Fiona, and Elizabeth, who were older that time, and we explained to them. Christopher and I told them that yes, Daddy had AIDS. AIDS is a terminal illness, and it is likely that Daddy would die soon. We were also very, very open about, you know, how you catch AIDS and how you don't catch it, which was very, very helpful, because Christopher had been very close with the children, and the children, they loved to jump into his bed. They loved to sit on his lap. They loved to be close to Daddy. They loved to hug. And he loved that, and he drew a lot of strength from the family being with him. And he worried from time to time whether they would catch the infection. But he, during the time that he had been in England, had read sufficiently about this disease and knew that he wouldn't pass the infection to the children. And that helped us to remain together as a family and kind of united against all odds, especially the stigma that was out there.
We're talking with Noreen Kaliba, who is the Community Mobilization Advisor for UNAIDS in Geneva. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Noreen Kaliba, who works for UNAIDS in Geneva. After her own husband died of AIDS in the 1980s, she founded TASO, Uganda's first AIDS support group. How did you come to found TASO, the AIDS organization?
This is the other element. The founding of TASO was really, again, as a reaction to, because as I described, the isolation, the feeling of stigma, the feeling of loss, and I mean losing a loved one, but also losing your own dignity, I began by seeking other people in similar situations. Because I was very convinced that if AIDS had crossed my own front door, it was very likely that already in my own country, it must have already crossed other front doors. So with the access that I had to the hospital, the teaching hospital, I began by going to the hospital wards and asking if there was somebody with AIDS that is admitted. And I remember one of the first people that I invited to Christopher's room so that we could cry and pray and just talk together was a very young couple, a man and a wife. And for me, again, that hit me very, very vividly, because in my culture, if a person is ill, they are nursed because of the resource shortages. There are not enough nurses on the hospitals. So if I need hospitalization, I need my mother or my sister or my sibling, a woman, a girl, to come with me to nurse me. But this young man, and who struck me really vividly, I found him nursing his own wife. And for me, it was a big shock to see a man nursing his wife. And when I asked him, I said, how come you are nursing your own wife? He told me, well, all my relatives have left because they were told that my wife and I have this new disease. And they were told by the healthcare workers that they shouldn't expose themselves. You see, there was such ignorance at that time with regard to how the infection is transmitted, that the information that was being passed on to family members was causing panic within families. So I began by looking for these people who were at the time with AIDS admitted on the hospital, and we began meeting in the room where Christopher was admitted. He began by sharing what he had read about the disease while he was hospitalized in England. And that was the seed, that was the foundation of this. Essentially, it was a support group for us to find some kind of meaning beyond the diagnosis in our lives. But within a year, it had blossomed to a group and a source of information, a source of support, a source of hope for many more. And I remember within the first year, we had extended our membership to 500.
I think the thing that shocked me most reading your book, We Miss You All, and Open Secret, I think, and some of the articles that I read about you, yeah, was the story about your attempt to help people in your family. You have, I may not have the figures correct, but you have at least four siblings who have HIV and six or more of their children that are HIV positive?
Exactly. I have four siblings and their spouses. Well, sadly, one of my sisters recently lost her husband. So four siblings and their spouses, and among the four, there are eight children who are HIV infected.
The thing that shocked me most, I think, was here in the West, and certainly in rich countries, we tend to think of the word triage as something that happens only in disasters. But you, yeah, have had to make decisions. You have had to make choices as to which of your relatives you are going to help fund antiretrovirals.
That, and yes, that I've had to make those choices. But that has only been made possible because of the most recent efforts that the global community has put in reducing the costs of these medicines. So the cost of drugs in developing countries has been relatively lowered. But even at the low price that is available in some developing countries, the dilemmas that exist, like in my family, today we have had to make a decision that out of the eight, only one, my brother Francis, can be supported on ARVs. And it's a difficult issue. Tomorrow I leave to go to Uganda to work. I have some work to do there. And I know that one of the things that will be painful will be we will have to sit within the family to review the situation, because my sister Harriet is in a very, very bad situation, is in a very bad state. If we don't put her on ARVs, we might not have her by mid-June. So Francis, one of my brothers, is now on antiretroviral therapy, but only thanks to the fact that in Uganda, you can access triple therapy for $200 a month. But the income that Francis has from his job as a driver is $20 a month. I have to subsidize that $20 to make available the $200. But $200 as compared to $1,800, which was the original cost of drugs before this movement, is different. Now, that having been said, he is carrying such a response. He's much healthier today. He's happier, and his family, we are all happier. But what about the rest of the family members? What about Andrew? What about George? What about Josephine, his wife? What about Rebecca, the little girl, the youngest in my family, who has HIV, is 3.5 years. And every time I look into the eyes of that child, I say, how can this child continue to suffer? She now is undergoing treatment for tuberculosis. And she has had to endure numerous injections. And every other day she has an opportunistic infection that comes up. I know that if she could access ARVs, the rate at which she gets those opportunistic infections would be drastically reduced. And she would be happy. She would still be HIV positive, but she would be looking forward to going to school. So all those dilemmas, and I share them at my past, but they are dilemmas that I see through my work on a day-to-day basis at communities in household levels. And that is part of my role here at UNAIDS, to keep that voice and keep that reality on the table on a daily basis when discussions are taking place.
Noreen Kaliba is the Community Mobilization Advisor for UNAIDS in Geneva. She is the founder of TASO, the first AIDS support organization in Uganda. We'll talk more with Noreen Kaliba in the second half of the show. I'm Margot Adler, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Audi. In performance, technology, and design, the goal remains constant. Never follow. Information available at AudiUSA.com. And National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips. Available in stores nationwide or online at NationalGeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with AIDS activist Noreen Kaliba. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording of the 1949 Jazz at the Philharmonic Concert at Carnegie Hall. And John Powers reviews the new French film, Time Out. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Margot Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's return to our discussion with Noreen Kaliba, who for more than 15 years has been an activist on the front lines of the AIDS epidemic in Africa. She founded TASO, one of the first AIDS support organizations in Africa, and she has written two books to help people with AIDS, We Miss You All and Open Secret.
I know that you write that your own culture is polygamous, that you were in a polygamous relationship. How does that issue affect the AIDS situation, and is that changing?
Polygamy, I do write that I came from a polygamous family. My father had four wives and had 28 siblings. But when I got married to my husband, I was determined not to live in a polygamous relationship. And when he strayed from our relationship, perhaps, and you must have read in my book, he strayed in search of a girl, a boy child, because we only had girls. That's another one.
So he blamed you, even though perhaps it wasn't you.
Exactly, yes. He was fed up of me not being able to make boys and went out in search of a woman who would make a boy. And sadly, he came back quite humbled by the experience, because he had another bonny little girl. So a lovely girl. My stepdaughter is one of my best friends today. But polygamy, to go back to the question of polygamy, has almost died a natural death. But unfortunately, I often look back in my own childhood and reflect and say, polygamy per se does not expose to HIV spread. It's what the individual members within the relationship do sexually that brings HIV into the relationship. And that's why in the messages that we started early in this movement, we were not necessarily discouraging polygamy per se, but we were saying, make polygamy safe. Because it is not polygamy that spreads AIDS, but it is the sexual actions of the members within that relationship. But increasingly, as the economy and as issues about love and values are becoming available to people quite clearly, polygamy is becoming extinct, as I said.
That brings up another question, which is the whole question of talking about sex, not only in regard to AIDS, but certainly it is very important in regard to AIDS. How easy or hard for people in Africa and in the communities you've been working with has it been to talk about sex, for women to talk about sex honestly with their husbands, for them to demand protection? And is that changing?
Sex and sexuality is a difficult issue in any part of the world, as I know it. I don't know any country where discussions about sex have always been open, and I think we are all globally learning. But in my part of the world, it has even been even more difficult. Even today, one of the vulnerabilities that we are trying to address, basically, is the gender imbalance in terms of ability for women and young girls to negotiate or even discuss what they want to do in their sex life. Many women that I cared for, many women today that are getting infected, young women, are sadly getting infected by their one and only sexual partner, who happens to be their husband, and who then must have strayed out of the relationship and brought the virus into the household. And women find it very difficult to discuss and say what they want to do in their sex life. But there are increasing programs that are targeting this particular issue, empowering women to be able to assert themselves. But also what we have discovered recently is that it doesn't work in many of these contexts to just target women without including the men. And what is now registering success are programs that are bringing a dialogue, and instead of empowering the woman, but empowering the couple and bringing the two together and highlighting the value that each one has for the other and ensuring that the discussion begins with the two rather than just focusing on the women.
One of the things I noticed in your book, Open Secret, was that you have many pages devoted to religious practices and the work of traditional religious healers and how they interact with AIDS work. And I'm wondering about that and what you are trying to do and what the situation is.
Yes, I think one of the key realizations that we have, I think we knew all along, but I think AIDS has loaned us the opportunity to affirm this, and that is human beings are spiritual. And when I say spiritual, I'm sure I don't mean religious, but they have a faith of some, and whatever they do, particularly in relation to how they behave, is really directed by that faith, you know. And we had the advantage in Uganda, and I think this advantage does exist in many African countries, that the majority of Africans go to a church of some sort. They worship, and they recognize a leadership that is derived from a church. They are very spiritual. But at the same time, quite a big number of the same people that are spiritual in the terms of the Christian faith or the Islamic faith, they all at the same time relate and consult traditional leaders and traditional healers simultaneously. So some of the programs that we describe in that little booklet relate to what did we do to, for example, to bring religious leaders on board. And the key message that I often want to share is it is consultation, dialogue, as opposed to confrontation. Mm-hmm. One of the areas that I have continually lamented is the confrontation that we public health workers have brought against the church on the question of condom use. In the sense that we have expected the church to stand, a church leader to stand on a pulpit and promote condom use. And I always say that is irresponsible. Why should we expect church leaders, faith leaders, Christians, Muslims to promote condoms? Because that's not their comparative advantages. Their advantage is in promotion of morality.
So what do you do? So what do you do? You yourself want to promote condom use, I am assuming.
Yes. Yes, what you do is you enter dialogue with them through a process that ends in them agreeing not to promote condoms, and you agree that they are not going to promote condoms, but for them not to condemn condoms. And I don't know whether you have read, there is a strategy that today is being taken up by different countries, which is described as A, B, C, as an AIDS prevention strategy. A, standing for abstinence. We have to agree that abstinence is possible. It's not right for anyone to say that it's not possible to abstain from sex, because it is possible and it is a choice that can be made by some people, but not by everybody. The B stands be faithful to your sexual partner. So if you are not abstaining from sexual intercourse, then be faithful to the sexual partner that you have. But we also know that being faithful is a situation that is not necessarily possible for everybody all the time. This is where the C comes in. And that is consistent condom use, consistent, because using condoms intermittently again doesn't help. So the dialogue that we entered in with the church was that if they would promote A and B and remain silent about C, so that if someone is looking for support in the areas of what can they do to protect themselves, they can point them to public health specialists that can discuss condoms, rather than saying, no, don't use condoms. And that, we know, once that marriage was struck, it worked beautifully in Uganda. It is working in many, gradually. But the moment you start confronting faith leaders, expecting them to do things that are not really in their remit, then the battle is lost.
What do you think you know now that this entire journey, what has it left you with? What is, if you had to say, your life has clearly changed in so many ways, but if there is one thing that you would say that has changed for you, that you have learned from this entire process, what would it be?
Wow. When I first came on what we call the front line, I was desperate. And very soon I lost my husband. And at that stage, it was really a very difficult thing to even believe that there is hope beyond an AIDS diagnosis. Over the last 15 years, I've been humbled, not only by because when Christopher was diagnosed, I thought we had had the worst deal in the whole world. But today I know better. We had a bad deal, yes, and I still lament it. But when I look at the lives of people that I have accompanied through this process, and look at how much less they have had with which to confront this pandemic, I'm very humbled. So I'm left with a sense of humility, but I'm also left with a sense of continuing frustration. And that is, as a member of the global community, I'm continually frustrated as to how much less we have done as a global community. We could have done much better. You look at how we are responding to the terrorist attacks. Look at how we responded to recent very grave calamities. If we had responded with the same vigor to HIV 20 years ago, the pain that we are suffering, that we have suffered, would have been offset. So I have hope, and I ask for more. I beg for more, and I have the voice, and I want to use this voice to beg for the international community to hold their and stretch their hands out a little longer into this global family, and help the AIDS situation.
Well, it's been really wonderful talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Noreen Kaliba is the Community Mobilization Advisor for UNAIDS in Geneva. She is the founder of TASO, the first AIDS support organization in Uganda. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a 1949 Carnegie Hall concert recording of Norman Granz's Jazz at the Philharmonic. This is Fresh Air. Producer Norman Granz began his all-star jazz at the Philharmonic Concerts in Los Angeles in 1944. Before long, the concept had evolved into a series of touring jam sessions starring top musicians who were well-paid and who often went out of their way to provoke an audience response. A 1949 JATP, Jazz at the Philharmonic Concert, has just been issued for the first time. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it confirms what a weird institution those concerts were.
Drummer Shelley Mann whipping up the crowd at Carnegie Hall, February 11th, 1949. There are a lot of Jazz at the Philharmonic records, but this newly issued one is the first with Mann or trumpeter Fats Navarro aboard. There are two good reasons to give a listen. Navarro was the most technically dazzling of early bebop trumpet players, but he wasn't around long. A heroin addict with tuberculosis, he died the following year at age 26, leaving too few records behind. Here he plays very much in the new bebop style. So does the drummer, dropping his newfangled bombs in the background. Fats Navarro didn't pander to the audience, but other musicians would play these crowds like a fiddle, tossing in licks sure to set them off. The band on this jam session includes thoughtful players like bassist Ray Brown and bebop idol Charlie Parker and his disciple Sonny Criss on alto saxes. None of them roused the rabble like the swing tenor saxophonist Flip Phillips. He played a lot of these tours and could manipulate an audience so well he'd work them into his accompaniment. Reactions like that suggest these audiences craved not brilliant improvising, but sheer propulsion. The sound of their heroes racing around the track was enough to make them cheer. Musicians understood that getting the crowd to react was part of the job, but some customers didn't need prodding. There's an odd episode during a quiet Hank Jones solo when the audience takes over. When they get so loud, you listen to them instead of the piano. It's one of those moments that let you hear the music in everyday chaos. Even the crowd pleasers could tire of these jousts, but Jazz at the Phil also featured smaller groups that gave everyone a chance to settle down. The other half of the 1949 Carnegie Hall program was for a quintet with Fats Navarro again on trumpet, along with the George Washington of the tenor saxophone, Coleman Hawkins. Here's Hawk on Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Lady. Even if JATP was only about musicians knocking heads, it'd still be an important social phenomenon. Producer Norman Granz insisted the concerts be open to integrated audiences when that was far from the American norm, and the music reflected a different kind of integration. In the 1940s, there'd been some loose talk about how bebop was a totally different animal from earlier jazz, but these concerts showed how easily musicians of different stripes and generations could play together. These concerts fostered a feeling of community that was hard to resist. That's partly why the roar from the house so often matched the one from the stage.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Norman Granz's Jazz at the Philharmonic, Carnegie Hall, 1949, on the Pablo label. Coming up, a review of the new French film, Time Out. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The French film Time Out, about an alienated businessman, has arrived from Europe where the critics loved it. It opened in New York and L.A. to the same kind of ecstatic reviews. Our film critic John Power says it deserves all the praise.
A couple of years ago, I was talking to a dear friend in the Bay Area and asked how she liked her job as a consultant. She told me that the only time she liked it was when she was driving from one appointment to the next. When she actually got there, she felt that her job had nothing to do with who she really is. But she couldn't quit because, well, you have to live. A lot of people feel exactly the same way, which is why it's so easy to understand Vincent, the unhappy executive at the heart of Time Out, the mesmerizing new French film that's as good as anything you'll see all year. When we first meet him, Vincent's on the cell phone with his wife Muriel, talking about his long day at the office. Their conversation couldn't be more ordinary, except for one thing. He's lying. His company actually fired him several weeks earlier, and though his family doesn't know it, he now spends his days driving around, hanging out in shops, and struggling to stumble across a new sense of self while ducking the necessity of landing another job. Eventually, he arrives at an elegant solution. He invents a new life. He goes to Geneva and pretends to land a UN job aiding economic development in Africa. Naturally, one lie leads to another lie to prop up the first. And as Vincent keeps digging himself in deeper, we anxiously wait for him to get caught, or snap. Time Out was directed by 40-year-old Laurent Canté, who's won huge international acclaim for exploring the one universal activity that artists always seem to ignore, work. His previous movie, Human Resources, was the smart, gripping story of a blue-collar kid who goes to college and winds up becoming a manager at the very factory where his dad is a union worker. Time Out vaults Canté's work to a new level. Not only has he raised his sights to the executive middle class, but his style now rivals Alfred Hitchcock's knack for being mathematically precise yet profoundly mysterious. This psychological thriller pulls you in just like quicksand. In a sense, it's strange that we should care what happens to Vincent, for he's not especially likable, nor is his quest for freedom as morally friction-free as it might be in a Hollywood movie. In order to pay for his family's middle-class life, Vincent actually starts bilking his old friends with a confidence scheme. And soon he's hooked up with a black marketeer who tries to teach him how to cross the shadow line between the criminal and the respectable. We enjoy seeing Vincent learn the ropes of living outside society. But Vincent himself doesn't feel altogether good about his new freedom. He's like an ex-con who misses his cell. The movie's carried by a riveting performance from Aurélien Recoing, a famous stage actor who, in his first lead film role, transforms the bottled-up Vincent into an encyclopedia of emotional nuances, little smirks of delight, microscopic tremors of regret, short-lived glimmers of exuberance as he tools around in his new ill-gotten SUV. Vincent knows that the jobs that he's fit for don't express his inner feelings or dreams. He, too, says that the only things he liked about his old job was the driving. Life is first boredom, then fear, wrote Philip Larkin, the poet laureate of glum ordinariness. Whether or not we use it, it goes. Vincent's attempts to use his life, or at least create a fictional life freer and more magical than his own, is not without a desolate sadness. Time Out's story is very loosely based on the notorious real-life escapades of one Jean-Claude Roman, who spent 18 years pretending to work for the World Health Organization in Geneva, and then, when discovered, murdered his family. Canté's too talented merely to mimic such a grisly scenario, and he gives Vincent's tale an unexpected turn you'd never find in a Hollywood movie like, say, Falling Down. Although we know that things can't possibly end well, Time Out's brilliant last scene offers us a vision of the modern world that's at once milder and more terrifying than anything suggested by the Roman case. As we gaze at Vincent's desperate face, flickering with tiny pains, dishonesties, and ambivalences shot through with suffering, Canté movingly shows us how, in the world of work, there are circles of hell of which Dante could never have dreamed.
John Powers is executive editor of LA Weekly. Later this week, I'll speak with the director of Time Out, Laurent Canté. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. The late bassist and composer Charles Mingus was born 80 years ago today. Next week, Terry Gross will speak with his widow, Sue Graham Mingus. We'll close with the 1959 Mingus recording, Goodbye, Pork Pie Hat. Mingus wrote it in memory of the saxophonist Lester Young. We play it today in honor of Mingus's birth. For Terry Gross, I'm Margo Adler.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Franklin Flyer, a novel set during the 30s and 40s by Nicholas Christopher, author of A Trip to the Stars. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
American Catholic cardinals are meeting in Rome this week to discuss the sex abuse scandals that have rocked the Catholic Church here. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with John Allen, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. I'm Margo Adler. Join us for the next Fresh Air.